Renicki off the bag at first. The pitch, he swings on this, a fly ball to left. Here comes Herndon. He's there. He's got it. The Tigers are the champions of 1984. They race on the field to Bob Hernandez. The Tigers have won the World Series.
Hey everybody, welcome to Put Me In Coach. It's a podcast all about baseball, and my name is Matt Coggins.
And I am named Carl Mizell. That is my given Christian name. How are you, sir?
I am fine. Nothing happened in sports this weekend, aside from the Red Wings winning another solid game. We had Octopus on the ice, and that is the only sport I will talk about. Well, aside from baseball, yeah, which is the podcast.
Nothing of note in any other sport has happened, so we will just pretend that that is true, and we will move on. All of that not sports stuff aside, how are you doing?
I'm living. I'm here. I've been listening to a lot of Bruce Springsteen lately to get me through my seasonal depression.
Get you through or push you further into it?
Mixed results.
Depends on the song or the album. Yeah. He's listening to the Ghost of Tom Joad on repeat. Get him out.
How about you? How are you doing?
I am great. I know I was telling you off pod that my children are exhausting, and that's fine because that's what you do. You have kids. They exhaust you. The pros outweigh the cons. But otherwise, man, I could not be happier. I've been teaching myself how to use different software programs to help the two podcasts that I'm part of be better. I'm learning how to use CapCut and edit videos and all kinds of great stuff. So I'm very excited to be learning. But more than that, I am excited to be talking baseball again with you because it's been 2 weeks because we recorded your magnificent Cleveland Spiders episode in one sit. So we had a week off, but we're back at it, and I think we're probably going to start going back to a weekly record, definitely once spring training starts in 2 weeks. So
I think that this one will be a fun, solid one episode that'll get us talking about one great guy opposed to several bad years for a certain team.
Yeah, no, it was funny. I was telling you, I've picked up the Hannes Wagner biography again. I cannot remember the author's name. But I just got to the part, like right around, we're now in 1901, but the Cleveland Spiders did get mentioned briefly in a paragraph, about a paragraph and a half. And they were like, yeah, they were terrible. But Pittsburgh was getting better and then moved on from there. So it was just kind of funny to have sat with you for almost 2 hours listening to the story and then watching it in a different context be condensed to a paragraph.
Yeah. I did want to shout out, we had a response from Cleveland Spiders historians and Cleveland librarians that were kind of contributing to some of the post-episode research, some of the maybe historical inaccuracies in my in my episode image. It's a picture of the 1887 or 1897 team. Mm-hmm. Because Cy Young was still in the picture. They didn't take a picture in 1899, so I did my best with the images that we were afforded. But I do appreciate that response, and I hope Clevelandites liked the tribute that we were able to give them. Josh Fekine, I hope you were listening to it.
Oh yeah, I know that he if he hasn't already, I know that he will. And I want to briefly say I always have a soft spot. I know because we're from Michigan, we're legally mandated to hate Ohio, but I've always felt a kinship with the city of Cleveland. I feel like Cleveland is like an annexed chunk of Michigan in Ohio. It's a great town, and I'm not just saying that because that is where my friend Josh is from. But I've never had a bad time in Cleveland.
South Detroit. Yeah, the Spiders did.
Yeah, there it is. Maybe we just uncovered it because people always say, don't stop believing. There's no such thing as South Detroit, which is a dumb thing. It's not a city. It's the southern part of the city. Anyway, but let's just call Cleveland South Detroit and move on from there.
What's
in the news?
What is in the baseball news, folks? Not much. We had the Hall of Fame. Adrian Beltre, Todd Helton, and Joe Mauer were elected to the Baseball Hall of Fame this week. There were some mixed results with some of these voters. Some of them were real assholes about the stuff that they picked. But these three guys definitely deserve to be in here. Beltre was nearly unanimous with 90% of the vote in his first year on the ballot. No other infielder in history has had 3,000 hits, 400 homers, and 5 gold gloves. He was a 4-time All-Star, 4-time Silver Slugger, 2-time Platinum Glove. His number 29 was retired by the Rangers, who he played for in the 2011 World Series.
Yes, a brief correction, because I know you wrote it. You said 90%. He got 95%.
Oh.
I don't want people. Yeah, you wrote 95% in your notes, but your mouth.
I appreciate that. Mouth did not follow eyes.
No, it did not. No, there are a lot of people that have this weird, there's still this weird antiquated belief that no player should be unanimous because Babe Ruth wasn't unanimous or Willie Mays wasn't unanimous. But just because other guys weren't unanimous doesn't mean that other dudes shouldn't be unanimous. And Adrian Beltre should have been, for a variety of reasons,
so
fucking
many reasons.
Unanimous. Lot of guys. Ken Griffey Jr. wasn't unanimous.
I saw some people be like, well, I didn't vote for him because he never won a World Series. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about?
We could do an entire episode on how much I hate that whole thing. Like when, like, well, Dan Marino can't be the greatest quarterback because he didn't win a Super Bowl. No, you fucking idiots. The Dolphins didn't win the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
That's how this works. It is a team sport. If you want to use that as a basis of comparison, might I introduce you to Roger Federer, you know, or the Williams sisters, you know, people who play individual sports. It's so dumb. And of course, Tony Maserati, the Boston sports talk guy, was like, oh, he was never the best player on his team. You know, when he was playing with A-Rod and this other, he was mentioning like guys that played with the Rangers and Ivan Rodriguez. He never played on the Rangers with the guys that he mentioned. And then he also conveniently ignored the fact that several times when he was with the Dodgers, based on WAR, which is a pretty convenient way to do this, he was the best player on the team.
Yeah. Generally speaking, that's why guys go to the Hall. I mean,
yeah, it is so crazy the things that people will come up with to keep a guy out of the Hall of Fame. Who else got into the Hall of Fame, by the way, Matt?
Oh, we had Todd Helton.
A guy who played in Colorado.
The Colorado Rockies, he was there his whole 17-year career. He's kind of squeaked in there with 79% of the vote, sixth attempt, or sixth year of eligibility, I guess. He was a masher, man. He won the batting title in 2000 with a .372 average, which is wild. Can you, imagine hitting that much now? I mean, Luis Arraez threatened last year and then didn't come close. So, I don't want to sound like an asshole if I'm wrong about that, but I don't think he came close.
No, I don't think so either. He faded real fast.
Yeah.
But no, it's crazy to think that that somebody did that as recently as 2000.
Yeah. Career numbers were awesome. Batting average was .316, on base percentage .414, slugging was .539. He was a 5-time All-Star, 4-time Silver Slugger, 3-time Gold Glove. His number 17 was retired by the Rockies, and it was their very first retired number in franchise history. That was in 2014. Todd Helton. I'm not as familiar with him, but maybe it's just because I didn't follow the Rockies when I was 7 years old, so
No, he was a great player. I mean, there's no two ways about it. But like I was telling you in our Discord, I hate the idea that people want to discount everything that he did because he played in Colorado. Then why even have a fucking team in Colorado if you're just going to dismiss anything that any player does for that team ever?
Absolutely.
You played in Colorado. Sorry, you can't make the Hall of Fame.
It's not like he didn't hit on the road, too. I mean, you don't get that average playing half your games at Coors alone, you know?
No, he didn't. I think his career batting average on the road was like over. It was over .280.
It ain't bad.
No, it's not. You do .280 for 17 years.
I think there's also a pastiche of like, well, he played on a shitty team, so he doesn't get to be in the Hall.
Oh, yeah.
It makes me wonder about guys like Miggy, who most people assume will be a first ballot Hall of Famer, but are they going to be like, well, he was in Detroit though. Detroit sucks. They sucked for most of his career. They never won a World Series with Miggy. Granted, Miggy did win a World Series, but, like, you know, what are the things people are going to say about people that are surefire bets? if they played for a World Series team, you know?
I don't know. I mean, Miggy had that great window with the Tigers from like 09, because he came over in what, 08?
That sounds right, 08.
Yeah, so 08 to 2015, so that, you know, those eight seasons, including the consecutive MVPs in 2012, 2013, the Triple Crown. I mean, the Tigers were phenomenal at that time. They were at one point the third highest payroll in baseball.
Yeah. I mean, you miss those days.
You know, yeah, I do miss those days, but you know who I don't miss? Joe Mauer.
Yeah, Joe Mauer. The third guy that went to the Hall this year, a well-deserved guy, as much as Carl and I did not like him as a lifelong Twins player who often battled with the Tigers and did very well against them. 76% of the vote. This was his first year on the ballot. He played all 15 seasons with his hometown Twins, and he's the only MLB catcher to win three batting crowns, leading the American League in 2006 and 2008 and 2009, when he was also the MVP in 2009. Six-time All-Star, five-time Silver Slugger, three-time Gold Glove. Number seven was retired by the Twins in 2019, and Carl used his Stathead tool, which has come in very handy in the last couple weeks, to research for me a question I had, because I recall this era of the Twins, and Joe Mauer and Justin Morneau particularly, were like, I never knew the names of other players on other teams. I knew those guys because they fucking destroyed. And Joe Mauer slashed 305, 385, 431 with 18 home runs, 122 RBIs, OPS of 816 in 216 games in his career against the Tigers. Which we just said, those were some of the best years of Tigers baseball in our lifetimes.
Yeah, yeah. And we always had to run into the damn Twins and Mauer and Morneau, and that was when they had Johan Santana as an ace at the time. And I couldn't tell you any other players off the top of my head, but those two, the M&M, you know, M&M boys, you never forget those. Morneau was an MVP winner at one point. And both of those guys could have had even better careers. But, I mean, Joe Mauer is a catcher. He gets beat to hell back there every day. And then Morneau had concussion issues towards the end of his career. So for Twins fans, I can understand why it might be kind of a bummer to think about that. But too bad.
Yeah, too bad. Which is what we're also going to say about a couple guys that didn't make it. Yeah. Billy Wagner, 422 career saves in his career, missed by 5 votes. He'll have one more year of eligibility. And Gary Sheffield is officially off the ballot. He only got 63.9%. He had 509 home runs. I mean, I liked Gary Sheffield when he played for the Tigers, but he definitely has a stink on him of being a steroid user and playing for the Yankees during that era of the juiced Yankees. And his son is kind of a dick on Twitter. His son just started. He was one of the main guys that was like, oh, so my dad doesn't go to the Hall, but Todd Helton does? Okay. Like, well, fuck you, man. Like,
They both should. Yeah, no, they both should be in. They both should be in, absolutely. One of them has the stink of steroids. The other doesn't. Now, that said, I don't care about steroids. I don't give a shit about any of that. Yeah. I think they should all be in. The fact that Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, A-Rod, like all those guys aren't in the Hall of Fame bothers the hell out of me.
Well, A-Rod I'm okay with.
Well, yeah, fuck that guy. But everybody else, I want them to be on the Hall of Fame. So I think Andrew Jones should be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
I think, you know, in which, as a brief aside, I would like to politely do a real quick PSA, because I saw something the other day that drove me crazy. Somebody was trying to relitigate the 1992 American League Rookie of the Year contest.
Why?
And they went into StatHead and they basically did like or Baseball Reference and compared both Pat Listash to Kenny Lofton, and they had extremely similar numbers except for the top row, which is WAR, and Kenny had like two full wins above replacement more than Pat Listash, but everything else was almost the same, like almost the same number of hits, RBI, that sort of thing. And that is why I want people to stop using WAR to relitigate baseball history. In 1992, nobody knew what the fuck WAR was. It wasn't a thing. If you would have looked at those two stat lines and said, these are both rookies, who do you think is better? They were virtually the same. But Kenny Lofton had two more WAR because he had the positional advantage of being a center fielder. That's it. Stop using modern analytics to relitigate. Why did this guy win MVP in 87? Fuck, man, I don't care.
Shit with the Trout-Miggy debate still. Yeah. And I'm just like, well, okay, Trout didn't hit the fucking Triple Crown. That's it.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's it, it. Yeah, maybe he had a more impressive season stat-wise, but he didn't have a Triple Crown.
And that is, I think that is a perfect example of what I think a lot of people try to say, which is war is valuable, but you also have to look at the bigger picture. Yeah. Sure, Mike Trout had an amazing season, but Miggy did something that hadn't been done in like 50 years.
Exactly.
So there you go.
Baseball,
anyway,
at the end of the day, is about stories more than stats.
And that's what we're here to do, is tell stories.
That's right. I think, you know, maybe we can talk about free agency later. We went a little long on the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, we did.
There's not much free agency news, so it's good enough to skip it. I did want to maybe touch on the Colt Keith extension from the Tigers briefly, if we could.
Yeah.
The Tigers extended prospect Colt Keith. He's slotted to play second or third base. A 6-year extension that could flex all the way to 2032. $29 million guaranteed, could go all the way to $82 million. He has never touched a Major League Baseball field. And he was only added to the 40-man roster when they signed this deal. He's only the 7th active player in history to sign with 0 days of service time. And it's sort of one of these moves that I like seeing. It's something that the Braves have been doing a lot. Yep. That's something that they did with Ronald Acuña and a lot of their other, like Ozzie Albies, some of their like up-and-coming players. Again, taking aside everything I've said about them, that's a cool move from their front office. To put faith in prospects generally means prospects get room to grow. But people, and I had this article from the Society of Baseball Research where they were sort of laying out like, okay, so there's polarizing options for this. You could have an Evan Longoria, 10 amazing years with your team, and he's still in the majors, you know? You could have a Wander Franco where it's like great player, but a lot of other shit happened.
He's got some baggage.
A little bit of baggage, just a little bit. Not currently on their roster, I don't believe. Yeah, it's a great investment in a guy that I think, I hope, I pray will be a great player. He's 22 years old. He's a 5th-round pick in 2020. Just skyrocketing through the minor leagues. Last year, he had 306, 380, 552 slash line in 126 games between double and triple A. And I think, importantly, more than anything people have been talking about this deal, the Tigers need infielders, period. Major league infielders. So, like, if you're going to give the guy the bank and say, hey, you're on the team this year, let's do it. That solves a major question mark that's been hanging over this team's head in the offseason that I think just got a check mark on it.
Absolutely. And there are some people out there who will poo-poo deals like this. They'll say it's anti-player because the player is, you know, bending the knee to the ownership. Quite the opposite. This is the ultimate compromise. He's guaranteed to make more money than he would have. I've had one of the sweetest things. My love language is people texting me about stuff like this, going, "Can you explain this to me?" and that's happened several times. As I have explained, he's now guaranteed to make more money for sure in his first 3 years than he would have, possibly in his seasons 4 through 6, because those are his arbitration eligible seasons. So let's say in his first 3 years he completely shits the bed. He's going to make more money in years 4, 5, and 6 than he would have. Conversely, let's say he goes out and fucking dominates. Let's just say he becomes like who's a great young infielder? I can't think of anybody off the top. But let's say he comes like fucking Juan Soto, but in the infield, right? Now, the Tigers got an excellent deal because Juan Soto just set the record for arbitration, you know, money earned in his arbitration years. Yeah. You know, okay, Colt Keith gave up that money in years 4 through 6, but years 7, 8, and 9, he's got those big options that the Tigers are definitely going to pick up. So he'll make it up on the back end. It's a win-win for everybody. I think these deals are awesome. And I think it is an excellent sign that the Tigers front office is changing with the times. And B, to your point, the Tigers need infielders. And you're not going to, what do you want to do? You want to go out and overpay some 32-year-old? You want to go get Justin Turner? You want to get 31-year-old Matt Chapman, who's only on the back end of his career, and let him logjam these guys? Or would you rather a guy stink up the joint for only 1.5 mil?
Exactly.
There
and
you
if
go.
He's bad, whatever, 1.5 mil. That's it.
Exactly. It's not your money anyway, but at least from a team standpoint, they're not going to be handcuffed by a huge contract. I don't want that. I don't want that for the Tigers. And luckily, there's nobody right now making an exorbitant amount of money for the Tigers and shitting the bed on a daily basis. Luckily, we don't have that problem at shortstop.
Hey, at least one less productive player is off the books this year, as much as we love him. But yeah, Javi Baez is a problem. all right. Carl, I think it's time we get to our main topic of the day.
Oh, I can't wait.
Take it away, my friend.
I want you to picture it. It's late October 2025, and the baseball discourse is dominated by the discussion of the performance of one Jacob DeGrom. Now, he missed the entire bulk of the 2024 season, recovering from his second Tommy John surgery, but then he returned to the dominant form that he'd established early in his career. But how he did it is what has everybody talking, not the fact that he's returned. Despite another season where he didn't pitch 150 innings, he racked up a stat line that could not be denied. A 9-3 record with an earned run average of 1.92 and 32 saves. And he did all of this in the span of 80 appearances, 68 of which saw him close out a game wherein he tossed 140.1 innings, which is a pretty good workload for pitchers these days. He didn't start a single game for the Rangers, but he was always there to pick up two innings here, three innings there, a save situation here, high leverage late game hold there. Now, a season like that might sound crazy, might sound a little far-fetched, but if DeGrom, or anybody for that matter, were to pull off that exact season, they would only become the second player in Major League history to pull off that feat. The first time somebody did it was in 1984, and the guy that did it not only won the Cy Young Award that year, but he also won the MVP Award and was a member of the team that won the World Series that year, making him only the third player in Major League Baseball history to pull off all three of those in one season. That man was Guillermo Willie Hernandez, and today we are going to take a look back at his career, his transcendent 1984 season, and we're going to discuss whether or not that 1984 season secretly held the blueprint for pitcher usage in the 21st century.
Hell yeah.
You gotta warn a guy. Now, before we continue, I want to reiterate something from that previous paragraph. No one except Willie Hernandez has had a season like he had in 1984. And I'm not talking about just in the modern era and not even just in the post-integration era. I am talking about the entire history of Major League Baseball, which goes all the way back to 1901. 124 years later, and he is still the only player to pull that off. And think about all the weird and esoteric stats and achievement that you hear broadcasters pull out of their asses during a game. It's always something like, with that base knock, Bobson Dugnut becomes the first player in Major League Baseball history to hit for the cycle under a waxing gibbous moon. It's ridiculous. Willie Hernandez is the only player in the history of the game to do what he did, but it took him an entire season to reach such absurdly esoteric heights. I'm not going to go to spend too much time going back into his early years, A, because it isn't really relevant to my thesis, but also B, there really isn't a lot of information about his early years out there. But what we do know is that he was born in Puerto Rico in 1954, the same year that Ruben Gomez, playing for the New York Giants, became the first Puerto Rican-born player to pitch in the World Series and the first Puerto Rican to win a World Series ring. Baseball was and is still a big damn deal in Puerto Rico. Sidebar, your B team has two of the best Puerto Rican players in the league right now in Edwin Diaz and Francisco Lindor.
Yeah, and our A team has one Puerto Rican player as well. Not great.
Is it the guy we were talking about earlier? I always forget.
Yeah.
It's that guy? Okay. Yeah, that's right.
It's that guy.
I forgot. The game
comeback
first
season this year. Comeback season this year.
Just get to two war. That's all I'm asking. The game of baseball was first introduced to the island of Puerto Rico in 1897 by a group of Puerto Ricans and Cubans who had learned the game in the United States. That same year, the first two baseball clubs on the island were formed, the Almendares Baseball Club and the Borinquen Baseball Club. According to a local newspaper article dated January 11th, 1898, those two clubs played the first organized baseball game in the island's history. And the game of baseball wasn't well received initially, as it was considered to be a silly, unmanly game by the sugarcane workers. That was a very, that was their top industry. And so those very macho men viewed it as a fit game, if you
will. I can see it. It's out of all the major sports, it is probably the least physical, physical contact sports.
Yeah.
Unless you're, what was that guy's name? Albert Bell, that was always punching people on his way to the bases.
Dude, just bowling the guys over. That opinion of the sport changed after the conclusion of the Spanish-American War in 1898. As part of America's peace treaty with Spain, Puerto Rico became an American territory. And because empires aren't going to spread themselves, America began stationing soldiers on the island. Those soldiers were permitted to form a baseball club to compete against locals as a diversional outlet. On November 4th, 1900, the Almendares Baseball Club defeated the American Baseball Club of the 2nd Regiment of the Infantry, 32-18. They had not learned how to name... I know, right? They hadn't learned how to name baseball clubs yet.
Well, also, I guess the pitchers were really struggling in that game. But
oh, it was
the Puerto Rican ones less, I guess.
Yeah, seriously. As local clubs continued to have success against visiting clubs from America, the popularity of the game soared on the island. Puerto Rico was a popular destination for barnstorming Negro League teams, and after the inception of their first professional league, Liga de Baseball Profesional de Puerto Rico, since renamed the Liga de Baseball Profesional Roberto Clemente, many Negro League greats took their talents to the island, including Josh Gibson, Satchel Paige, and a 19-year-old Hank Aaron.
Oh, shit. That's so cool. Did we talk about this during World... I feel like we didn't cover this in depth, but I think we touched on this during World Baseball Classic time, which would have been a full year ago. But it's so fascinating how some of these American-adjacent places, well, I guess now America, but have incorporated our baseball culture and embraced it so heavily. That's so cool.
Yeah. It's one of the most fascinating things. As a sidebar, I haven't watched it yet, but Baseball Doesn't Exist, the great channel on YouTube, just did an hour-long video about how Japan took over baseball. And I'm really excited to see it because that guy does some excellent work.
Hell yeah.
Speaking of Roberto Clemente, right around the time that Puerto Rican legend Roberto Clemente was approaching or passing the 3,000 hit mark, Willie Hernandez was a high school baseball player. But at that point, he was playing first base and occasionally manning the outfield. He didn't take up pitching until 1973, when due to the injury of one player and the suspension of another, he was asked to take the mound. It wasn't long before he reportedly developed a 100-mile-per-hour fastball and an 85-mile-per-hour breaking ball. After he graduated that same year, he put those pitches to use for the Tiburones de Aguadilla, or the Aguadilla Sharks, in the aforementioned Liga de Baseball Profesional de Puerto Rico. That's so fun to say. But that stint was cut short when he signed with the Philadelphia Phillies for $25,000 that September, kicking off his professional baseball career.
It's so crazy. Straight out of high school?
Yeah. That's how they did. I mean, that's pre-draft.
Yeah.
The draft was, I think the first draft was 76, 77, somewhere around there. Rick Monday. I remember Rick Monday being the first overall pick. So yeah, this is still back when they would scout and just sign guys. He was actually scouted by Ruben Amaro Sr., who I believe, I can't remember if he was the general manager for the Phillies for a long time or if it was his son, but there was a Ruben Amaro that was a GM for the Phillies fairly recently. Hmm. The earliest days of Willie's professional career found him turning in solid but not spectacular seasons. In 1974, he spent the season in A-ball, compiling a perfectly cromulent 11-11 record across 26 starts, striking out 179 batters in 190 innings, and he tallied an earned run average of 2.75. The next year, 1975, saw him make the leap to AA, where he jumped out to an 8-2 record in 11 starts before jumping again to AAA and going 6-4 across 13 games, 11 of which he started. His rapid ascent through the Phillies organization hit a speed bump in 1976. That year, he struggled to the tune of a 4.53 earned run average, a losing record, and significantly fewer strikeouts, 88, than innings pitched, 135. For the lay people at home, that's a strikeout rate of 5.9 Ks per nine innings, also known as not that good. how not good exactly? Amongst all qualifying pitchers in 2023, Jordan Lyles had the lowest K per nine rate at 6.1 strikeouts per nine innings. When you've hit Jordan Lyles levels of performance, you should start creating custom searches on apartments.com because you're probably going to be going somewhere else.
Can I ask a qualifying question for this period? What is the average pitcher like during these mid-70s? Because, I mean, you know, just a couple of years ago, we had the live ball, the super live ball, the bouncy ball era. And now, the last couple of years, we've had sort of a more, not literally dead ball, but with the pitch clock, with all these new rules, with the less bouncy ball, pitchers have been a little more dominant. What were these 70s like? What were his peers like, I guess, to ask?
That's a really good question. I mean, at that time, I think that was kind of like an offense-neutral standpoint. If I remember, I was actually reading, what book was I reading? I think it was Howard Bryant's. It was Howard Bryant's book about the steroid era, and he was talking about how Bill James was talking about great offensive eras. And if I remember correctly, like the 70s and into the 80s was sort of neutral, because you have to remember 1968 was the year of the pitcher. That was the year that Bob Gibson, you know, led the all baseball with a 1.12 earned run average, and then they raised the mound. They lowered the mound, and they did all kinds of stuff to try and make it better for hitters. So I think we were in sort of like a pretty standard era of offense,
and everybody's on the same amount of amphetamines and cocaine.
Exactly.
Too. So the level playing field with the drugs.
Yeah, steroids hadn't really become a thing yet. It was all meth and coke at that point. So I think that's about. I think that answers your question.
Okay. Yeah, I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. The Phillies apparently had seen enough of Willie, and they left him unprotected in the 1976 Rule 5 draft, which we've discussed on the show before. The Cubs pounced, the Chicago Cubs, that is, making him the fourth pick of that year's supplemental draft. The Cubs immediately transitioned him to a full-time reliever, and on April 9th, 1977, he made his big league debut, giving up just one hit and no runs across 2 1/3 innings. His performance that season seemed to justify Chicago's investment in Willie. He appeared in 67 games, all but one in relief, compiling in... I want to make sure. I was like, that doesn't sound right. Let's just assume that he was relief in 66 and started one. I think that's what I meant.
Okay.
He compiled an 8-7 record and 4 saves to go along with a 3.03 ERA and an ERA plus of 145, meaning that he was 45% better than the average pitcher that year. So for those of you who aren't familiar, modern baseball stats have plus attached to them, like OPS plus or ERA plus. And those are statistics that takes external factors such as the ballparks you played in out of the equation, and it makes 100 average. So if a pitcher has an ERA plus of 100, he is perfectly average for that year. So an ERA plus of 145 means Willie was 45% better. Now, you would think, or you'd like to think, that being 45% better than most of your counterparts would be a recipe for success. But in Willie's case, he happened to find himself in the wrong place at the wrong time. Because you see, Willie wasn't the only emerging relief pitcher the Cubs had in their bullpen in 1977. They also had second-year reliever and future Hall of Famer Bruce Sutter, who after a solid 1976 season absolutely broke the hell out in 1977. That year, he appeared in 62 games, going 7-3 while racking up 31 saves, a 1.34 ERA, and a mind-boggling 328 ERA plus, 328 ERA plus, meaning that he was 228% better than the average pitcher that year.
Jesus Christ.
And as if that wasn't dominant enough, he also sported a FIP, fielding independent pitching, of 1.61. Amongst all relievers that season who appeared in at least 40 games, Suter's FIP was almost a full point better than his nearest competitor, fellow Hall of Famer Rich Goose Gossage, who finished that year with a FIP of 2.51.
I'm glad I asked about how these compatriots were doing in the 70s, because it's insane to have those two guys on the same fucking team.
Right.
And then Goose Gossage is, who was he playing with?
At that time, I think he was with the Padres at that time. He was either the Padres or the Yankees, I think. He bounced around. You know who else the Cubs had around that same time as well was another Hall of Fame reliever. I don't think they overlapped at that point, but they had Lee Smith. They had Lee Smith and Bruce Sutter in the same fucking bullpen. Oh God.
They won the World Series, right?
Who won the World Series?
The Cubs?
They must
have done something very successful.
Oh, they were so great. They did win the World Series, like 46, 47 something years later. But the groundwork was laid with Lee Smith and Bruce Sutter. I'm sure. I'm confident of it.
There you go. It all starts there.
That's where, I mean, I think if you really paid attention, the signs are there. The next few seasons were full of ups and downs for Willie. In 1978, he had another good but not great season, posting an 8-2 record with a 3.77 ERA, 38 strikeouts in 59 and two-thirds innings. All right, fine. Great. But the next three seasons saw him struggle, going at 5-13 over the next three seasons, only recording two saves to go with a 4.61 ERA over that span. He started out 1982 strong, striking out 18 batters in the first 19 and two-thirds innings that he pitched across 11 appearances, and he notched a pretty decent 3.20 ERA. So you see kind of a pattern forming here. Willie's always just sort of like on the cusp, but not quite breaking through. His stint in Chicago would come to an end that May when he was traded back to the team that first signed him, the Philadelphia Phillies. His impact was immediate. He served as the setup man for closer Al Holland, and he had another fine season, going 8-4, 3.29 ERA across 95 and two-thirds innings. And he didn't just contribute on the mound. Hernandez also contributed at the plate, going 5-13, which is a .385 batting average. He drove in one run, scored two more, and even stole a base. He's a proto Shohei.
Hold on. Pitchers hitting? What is this? What's going on here?
Cats and dogs living together? the Phillies, I had nothing else to add to that. The Phillies would go on to clinch the National League pennant that year, but would ultimately fall to the Baltimore Orioles in the World Series. That seems fucking wacky. Hernandez was dominant, appearing in three out of the five games they played throughout the playoffs, striking out four and holding the Orioles hitless across four innings of work.
Damn.
I know. It was great. He didn't pitch at all. He didn't pitch in the National League Championship Series, but those appearances all came in the World Series, just for clarity. While Hernandez was contributing for Philly in the World Series, the Detroit Tigers were watching at home and licking their wounds after having finished second in the American League East. Now, the Tigers front office at the time knew that upgrades were needed primarily in two areas, third base, and they needed a lefty arm in the bullpen. The Tigers already had Aurelio Lopez, a dominant right-handed relief pitcher. He dominated during the 83 season, but lefties proved to be a thorn in his side. His ERA against lefties was over a full run higher than against righties. It was 3.48 against lefties versus 2.21 against righties. And their BABIP, or their batting average on balls in play, was almost 100 points higher, 2.280. What am I saying? 280 to 192. I know how to say numbers. Third base would ultimately be shored up by the emergence of Howard Johnson, their first-round draft pick from 1978, not the guy the hotels are named after. I think.
Damn it. I was just going to ask that.
Yeah. I'm actually surprised you remember the Howard Johnson chain of hotels. I feel like that's something that only us olds remember. But
there's a random one in Saginaw that's been closed probably for 20 years, but it's still there. Just like you go pass by it on Bay Road, I think, and it's just sitting there. Howard Johnson, it's probably dusty inside, but
there used to be one across the street from the Cortland Mall. It was always the Hojo's. We call it the Hojo, but it's long gone. Where was I? Oh yeah, but a trade was necessary to address their need for a lefty. They got help in that regard on March 24th, 1984, when they traded outfielder Glenn Wilson and the versatile but declining John Walkenfuss to the Phillies in exchange for Hernandez and first baseman Dave Bergman. Brief aside, if you ever want to see something just mind-boggling, go look up John Walkenfuss and see if you can find a picture or a video of him in the batter's box, because he had one of the most bizarre batting stances you will ever see. He practically had his back turned to the pitcher. And his fingers were always wiggling. It was weird.
Oh, shit. You're not kidding. What the fuck?
Right? It's weird, isn't it?
Sorry, I see it now. It's like, yeah. It's like if Pete Alonso took that and turned it another 90 degrees. Like, yeah. This is fucking insane.
Put that in the show notes, please. the Detroit Tigers came roaring out of the gate at the start of the 1984 season, pun fully intended, setting a still unbeaten record for the best start after the first 40 games, going 35-5 and laying the foundation for their wire-to-wire American League East victory. During that stretch, Hernandez appeared in 15 games, striking out 21 batters over 27 innings, but only picking up 4 saves due to the Tigers' dominance during that stretch. But in those 4 saves, Hernandez averaged 3 innings per appearance, never going fewer than 2 innings. On May 4th, Hernandez recorded a 4-inning, 12-out save against the Cleveland Indians, now the Guardians, allowing 2 hits and striking out 3 in the effort. This would become a common occurrence for Willie in the 1984 season. If you recall, at the outset of this episode, I mentioned that Willie threw just over 140 innings in his 80 appearances that year, which is just a shade under 2 innings per appearance. It's like 1.75 innings per appearance by average.
Now, one thing I do know about this era is that starters went deeper than they do nowadays. But this is an interesting wrinkle that I'm sure will come into play, that this is a bullpen guy that can go multiple innings. That's so fun.
Yeah, you've actually foreshadowed 2 things that I'm going to bring up later. Which I'll be like, hey, remember when you foreshadowed that? It'll be great. We'll have a chuckle. Well, now, while Willie is getting a lot of love in this episode, and rightfully so, I'd be remiss if I did not come back to his right-handed counterpart in the pen, Aurelio Lopez. Despite Willie getting all the accolades at the end of the season, for much of the first half of the 1984 season, Hernandez was almost exclusively setting up for Lopez until mid-May, and then only took over the closer's role a few weeks later in mid-June. That, combined with the aforementioned dominance by the Tigers, makes Willie's season all the more remarkable. Even though the Tigers were making save opportunities hard for anyone to come by, Willie didn't start getting the closing nod until a third of the way through the season. And the key to his dominance was the combination of 2 pitches, a cut fastball and a screwball. And he could run the cutter up and in on righties, either sawing them off or serving to sort of back them off the plate. And if he managed, if the batter managed to avoid getting a broken bat or hitting a weak pop-up, he'd then drop the screwball down and away, leaving them flailing helplessly as the pitch's confounding arm side run sent the pitch tumbling away. Now, I know that this is an audio medium, so when I say arm side run, Willie was a left-handed pitcher. So when I say arm side run, when he releases the ball goes to his left, which is weird. It's if you've ever tried to hit somebody who has a lot of arm side run, it's very difficult to do. And the screwball looks like a curveball is going the wrong way, which makes it such a tough pitch to hit. The closest thing that you will see to it these days is Devin Williams' changeup. That's the closest thing you're going to see to a screwball these days. It's so much like a screwball that in MLB The Show, they just call it a screwball because they can't make everybody else's changeup look like his.
Screwball was what all the teachers called me in high school.
Comparatively, the cutter has what would be called glove side run. So when he throws it from his left hand, it goes towards his right side or in on a right-handed hitter, away from a left-handed hitter. And then conversely, a cutter would go away from a left-handed hitter and a screwball would go down and in on a left-handed pitcher.
And is he still throwing the 100 mile an hour four seam?
No, he is not. By all accounts, he had a perfectly average fastball at this time. So back then, I think the average fastball velocity was around 90, like high 91, like 91.8 to 92.2, I think. Somewhere in there was the average fastball velocity. So perfectly average, but this is what we would say these days, tunneling. We now better understand tunneling. So it's coming out of the same slot, and it looks like, go to Twitter or go to YouTube and watch any Pitching Ninja video.
Pitching Ninja,
He gives a great examples of he'll show overlays of how the two pitches work together, and that's why these two pitches were so strong together. It's the same reason like some guys that have low 90s fastballs, like he only throws 91, but he still has the confidence to throw the fastball up in the zone, which at this point in the 80s was a no, you never throw the fastball up. Well, now we understand that more backspin, creates less pull on the ball from gravity. So when people say, oh, he has a rising fastball, no, he doesn't. He just has more backspin, which makes the ball resist gravity more, which then begets the sticky stuff and et cetera, et cetera.
Exactly.
So there you go. Now, Willie's dominance continued throughout the remainder of the season. By late August, he'd protected all 39 leads that he'd been handed, and he didn't blow a save until September 27th, the 159th game of the season.
Holy shit.
By season's end, I know, right? He compiled a season that had never happened before and has yet to be replicated. 80 appearances, 68 games finished, both league bests, a 1.92 ERA, and a over 140.1 innings pitched, 32 saves, 96 strikeouts against only 36 walks, an ERA plus of 204, meaning he was 104% better than the average pitcher that year, and a FIP of 2.58. Fielding independent pitching, by the way, is a statistic that only counts the things that pitchers can control. So walks, strikeouts, it's only the things that he can control. It doesn't account for balls in play. His 32 saves were recorded consecutively, which stood as a record until Eric Gagne obliterated the record, recording 84 consecutive saves between 2002 and 2004. Now, recording 84 consecutive saves is absolutely an achievement that is worthy of merit, but it should be noted that only 18% of Gagne's saves saw him record more than three outs. By comparison, Hernandez recorded more than three outs in 66% of his saved games, going two or more innings 18 times in that stretch.
That's also, I think, discounting what Hernandez did in those games the Tigers had handily that weren't save opportunities, I think.
Exactly. No, yeah, he was phenomenal. Again, it would be easy to say, well, they were dominant. He didn't do anything. Well, he could have shit the bed.
You know? Exactly.
He could have done that. You know, he could have gone out and Todd Jones'd his way through every freaking game. Yeah. Unsurprisingly.
You know, the closers that we as Tigers fans know very well these days.
Yeah, I love watching. I think he's great when they do those, like, players-only broadcasts on whatever they're calling that now, Bally, Diamond, whatever. I'm more comfortable with him there than I was on the mound. I love the guy.
Yeah.
But, I was prematurely gray because of that man. Unsurprisingly, Willie Hernandez continued to play an integral role in the Tigers' run to a World Series victory. During the 1984 playoffs, he appeared in six of the eight games the Tigers played throughout the playoffs, because back then they only had the championship series and the World Series. Mm-hmm. He recorded three saves, allowing only seven hits and recording an earned run average of 1.97. And he would be rewarded for his work that year with the Cy Young Award, the MVP Award, and a World Series ring. Only Sandy Koufax and fellow Tiger Denny McClain had managed that feat before Willie did it. I forgot to see if anybody else has done it since, but I doubt it, because I think the only pitcher to win both awards was Justin Verlander since then. In winning the Cy Young, he also notched his place in Puerto Rican baseball history as the first Puerto Rican to win the award, and he would remain the only Latino player to win the award until Felix Hernandez claimed it in 2010. I really wish that I could tell you that Willie continued his meteoric ascent, but 1984 would ultimately prove to be his peak. He'd go on to pitch well over the next two seasons, recording 55 saves over that span and posting a respectable 3.04 earned run average. As he started to lose his groove, he also started to lose the trust of the fans and the media. After a poor performance in his only playoff game in 1987, giving up two runs on two hits in one-third of an inning and taking the loss, Detroit Free Press columnist Mitch Albom published a column entitled "Familiar Nightmare, Hernandez on the Mound." In the column, Albom excoriated Hernandez, writing, quote, "As he walked to the mound with one out in the eighth Wednesday night, you could almost hear the squeals of delight among the sellout crowd here. Perhaps the fans knew that hurt in crucial situations lately. Willie Hernandez has been about as effective for the Tigers as pulling down their pants." Willie would respond the following spring training by dousing Mitch Albom with a bucket of ice water, upsetting no one. Albom complained to the Tigers executives, but they declined to discipline Hernandez, upsetting no one except Mitch, but who fucking cares because it's Mitch Albom. He pitched well in 1988.
Fuck Tuesdays at Maury.
Yeah. No, really. Seriously, let's unpack this. I really don't like Mitch Albom. I think he's a turd, and he thinks he knows more than everybody, and I just don't like him.
Do you remember when he used to have... He had a show. I don't know if he still does, but he used to have a show on WXYZ that was... And I remember the Albom was the like his bumper music. And he was... If you know who Sal Licata is in New York sports media... Just an absolute fucking, like, talks out of his ass about every Detroit sports team and just has no fucking... He's the Mike Valeni nowadays.
He was a pre-Mike Valeni. Yeah. I miss Rob Parker, who has now gone national and turned into a big turd, because that's what apparently you have to do to stay relevant is make hot takes. Anyway, he pitched well. Willie pitched well, not Mitch Albom. He probably never threw a ball in his life. He pitched well in 1988, but was only called upon to go 67 innings that year, a far cry from the workload he had in 1984, which still stands as, well, why wouldn't it? Because the 80s are over, but it stands as the fourth highest single season workload for a relief pitcher in the 80s. So think about that. That thing that we talked about, the 140 innings in one season, that was still only the fourth highest workload for a relief pitcher in the 1980s.
Jesus.
So the 80s were wild, but we're going to talk about that later. His relationship with fans continued to sour, with fans going so far as to boo him on opening day in 1989.
Yikes.
And that would be his last season, not only with the Tigers, but for his career. Injuries would plague him for the next few years, preventing multiple comeback attempts that saw him try to catch on with Oakland in 1990, Philadelphia, and Toronto in 1991. After a three-year layoff, he was desperate to get back onto a big league roster. Willie tried to scab for the Yankees during the player strike in 1995. There was a quote that I left out, but basically he was like, I'm not trying to break a strike, I'm just trying to make a roster. That's what breaking a fucking strike is, Willie.
Yeah.
He appeared in one spring training game against the Braves, throwing six pitches and recording outs on the only three batters he faced. Only 10 years removed from his heyday, Willie was a superstar in the clubhouse, fielding autograph requests from starstruck teammates, but not everybody was happy to see Willie back on the field. Sparky Anderson, his manager with the Tigers in 1984, was asked by Bob Nightingale about Willie's comeback, and Sparky said, quote, "It's sad. The whole thing is sad. Why would someone want to come back when their career is over? Why would anyone want to come back to this?"
Holy shit. Damn, yeah. Sparky, damn. Also, side note, Bob Nightingale was writing in the early 90s. How long has that guy been around?
Oh, yeah. Boob's been around for a while. That reminds me. I got to put the link. That article is actually still available. I didn't add that link to the show notes, but I'll put it in there. After that comeback attempt, Willie finally hung up the spikes. He settled into a comfortable life as a business owner back in Puerto Rico, running a construction company for a time before selling that and taking up cattle ranching. His health after that began declining rapidly, seeing him develop asthma and diabetes. He suffered multiple strokes. In 2009, he had heart surgery. He would live long enough to be welcomed back to Detroit in 2019 to throw out the first pitch for the Detroit Tigers home opener that year. Sadly, Willie Hernandez passed away on November 20th, 2023, at the age of 69. It was the 1984 Tigers that made me fall in love with baseball, and as I've grown up, it's bugged me that more people seem to have forgotten what he did that season. When I pitched this to Matt last fall, I'd originally intended just to tell Willie's remarkable, the story of his remarkable season, but then an idea occurred to me. What if Willie's 1984 season was actually a blueprint for how teams use pitchers in the future? Now, on the surface, it isn't too far-fetched. In 2023, here we go. Remember what we were talking about earlier. In 2023, 76 pitchers threw over 140 innings, with only five working over 200 innings. Back in 1984, 107 pitchers cleared the 140 innings mark, with Willie bringing up the rear at 140.1 innings pitched. And a whopping 52 pitchers worked over 200 innings. Dave Steeb led the league that year with like 262 innings pitched. So think about that. 52 pitchers. Yeah, over almost 40 years. So 39 years apart. Just five pitchers this past year cleared 200. Back in 84, 52. 10 times the amount of pitchers cleared that number.
Shit.
Yeah. Now, it's no surprise that pitchers have significantly reduced workloads compared to their predecessors, but even with those reduced workloads, guys are still succumbing to injuries. Much has been written about the correlation between overuse of pitchers and injuries, and quite frankly, I'm researched the hell out at this point. So if you're listening to this show, you probably aren't shocked to hear that a lot of dudes end up getting Tommy John surgery. What you might be shocked to learn is how many are getting it, though. According to the Tommy John surgery list maintained by the diligent John Rogala? How would you be? R-O-E? Yeah,
it almost
Rogala.
Looks like
John
Mangala. Well, not the best
it does.
Name to bring up in connection, no. But...
That was the best you could do. You couldn't go.
But it does.
John, if you're listening, I'm really sorry.
We know you're not a Nazi, although you are a surgeon. So
there you go. Two guys had the surgery in 1984, Paul Molitor and Chuck Porter. Both played with the Milwaukee Brewers, and Paul Molitor was an infielder. Chuck Porter was a pitcher. In 2023, 92 players across all levels of professional baseball had the procedure, and that doesn't even take into account the number of college and high school players who've had the procedure. According to one public data set, the number of TJ surgeries done on athletes under 21 was fewer than 10 total from the inception of the surgery in 1974 to 2003. But by 2017, at least 80 were being performed on that same age group per year. Yeah, maybe I wasn't that researched out after all.
Yeah, man, that's some stats. That's some stats, and that's scary.
It is.
Is it?
It's scary.
Yeah.
It's extreme, and it's extremely scary. And there's a great chapter if you read. I think it's called The Inside Game by Keith Law. He talks about survivorship bias, and because whenever people talk about, and I know you've heard it, I've heard it, and people say, "Well, pitchers are soft these days. Look at Nolan Ryan." That's survivorship bias. We know Nolan Ryan because he survived. We don't know the countless hundreds of other dudes who didn't make it because they were just told to throw until their arms fucking fell off.
Yeah.
And research as early as the late 1980s was starting to show that there was a direct correlation between overuse and injury. We know it. It's all there. So with all that to consider, I don't think that it's too far-fetched to revisit the scenario that I presented at the beginning of the episode. We could sit here and come up with all sorts of what-if scenarios, but let's keep our focus on DeGrom. Here's a guy, for the first six seasons of his career, averaged 183 innings pitched per year. But since that time, excluding the COVID-shortened 2020 season, he's averaged 62 innings per season. But for the sake of the conversation, I will mention that he threw 68 innings across 12 starts in that shortened 2020 season, averaging just under 6 innings per start. Which would you rather have? A healthy DeGrom who might give you 10 great starts in the regular season and then his arm falls off? Or would you rather have a slow IV drip of that same quality stuff you get through the regular season and hopefully into the playoffs? Imagine, think about it, what the Rangers' run to the World Series victory last year could have looked like if they had Jacob DeGrom looming in that fucking bullpen. Think about that. And that's the end of the actual like presentation portion of the episode. But this is the part that I was really excited to talk about, because I think it's fascinating to think what is going to happen with pitchers and pitching as we go forward. Because I don't think it's far-fetched to say, hey, we've got this guy who is transcendently talented, but he can't stay healthy. So why don't we just keep him in the pen and bring him out when we need him? He can throw 20 pitches today. He can take a day off. Maybe he's available. Maybe he's not. He can come out and throw 15 tomorrow. He rests a day. Maybe he can go 30. I think that is and he's still, with that workload, still getting to almost 140, 150 innings. It wouldn't be hard for a pitcher to still get 150 innings while coming out of the pen. I really think, and I know that a lot of people hate it when they talk about like, oh, but it used to be like, you know, I remember going to a Tigers game and it was Verlander versus Sabathia. It's one of the best games I ever got to see, right? You know, you're not going to have these, you might not have these marquee matchups anymore, but I would much rather guys not suffer potentially career-ending injuries and stay healthy. That way they can be on the field as opposed to not. I mean, think of if Shohei Ohtani was just a pitcher. We're going to miss all that for a year. We're going to miss Felix Bautista this year, one of the most electric closers in the game right now. I mean, we missed Edwin Diaz. Now, I know that was obviously a far different situation, but think, I mean, there's so many that you can't even think of one off the top of your head. But what do you think? What would you like to see? Where do you think this is going?
Honestly, I would prefer that. I think we've seen success stories from it. You know, like the Tigers alone, we had Michael Fulmer won Rookie of the Year in 2016 because he was such a dynamite starter for a really shitty team. And people really gravitated towards that and really liked him for that. And then he started to lose his stuff as he progressed and had some injuries and came back from those injuries. They put him in the pen. And then in the pen, he went to kind of inherit a semi-closer role and excelled in it. And it was one of those things where you were so confident to see him come out and save a game, or at least set up the save to a game to less dominant closers like Gregory Soto. And yeah. And I think that there's room for that even with aging pitchers. Max Scherzer. All last year, I would see Scherzer try to start games for the Mets. And it would usually be like 2-3 innings of dominant, awesome baseball, and then something would happen to like fuck with his head, and suddenly the game just derails. When we were covering the World Series last year and they were talking about starting Scherzer, I was like, this is fucking stupid because he can't do this for 5-6 innings. He can maybe, you can maybe squeeze 2 or 3 out of him, but Texas's bullpen was really weak and not very deep. And I was like, put Scherzer in the bullpen, start literally anybody else. And I think they did shorten his starts, but I think that there's room for a guy like Scherzer, maybe a guy like Verlander a couple years down the line, if he's still in the game. Guys that are nearing the end of their careers, but still have some good stuff and still maybe have something to prove on the field. I think that there's room for them in this role.
Yeah. I think that isn't, I hadn't even considered that aspect of it. The one that I'm thinking of is the one that I see a lot of people bemoaning the lack of. The people that, usually the people that want to see the designated hitter go away. I want to see pitchers hit. I like the strategy. I want to see a guy who hasn't swung a bat since high school try to hit off a Justin Verlander.
Sure.
Sound fun to me, right? This brings that back. So think about it. You could right now you can have, I think, up to 13 pitchers on your roster, which I think is far too many, and it has turned bench management into a nightmare for most managers that I couldn't even imagine trying to deal with. Shrink that number back down, and then it becomes sort of a pitcher roulette where, you know, teams are trying to get into other teams' bullpens deeper. Like at the beginning of a series, everybody's rested. Let's try and get to DeGrom in the first game. Let's try to get to DeGrom in game one. Let's tire him out so he won't be there in game four. Like, you know, or even out throughout the regular season, like you're looking further ahead and you're trying to figure out, oh, well, you know, we got so-and-so coming into town and we know that, well, let's just say, fuck it, let's just keep it. We know they got the Rangers in town and DeGrom didn't pitch in that last series. So we know he's fresh. So we're probably going to see him in game one. You know, let's try and keep him out of there. We might even see him in game two. We might imagine the possibility of having to see Jacob DeGrom 3 consecutive games.
Yeah.
Even for just an inning or two. Like, that's a nightmare. Would you rather DeGrom go 6 innings in one game or 2 innings in 3 games?
Definitely the latter.
Right? Think about that. I think it is exciting to think about. I don't give a shit who starts the game. I want to know who wins at the end. I want to see the whole game. I am a degenerate. I will watch any baseball game. I am a complete degenerate. I am different. I get it. But I think down the line for the health of the sport overall, I think this needs to be something that is considered because we can't keep losing guys. We can't. Sports need to evolve. And this game has evolved. Back in the late 1800s and early 1900s, foul balls were not strikes. You could just sit there and just keep hitting pitches and fouling them off until a pitcher walked you or you got a hit. It was only 1900 when that was implemented. But even then, a game that was 24 years old, 25 years old, they made a change. But now all of a sudden, we've just decided we can't make any more changes. So yeah. I think the game has to evolve, and I think this is one of the best ways to evolve it.
You are seeing the emergence of the long reliever, as they call them, which are sort of like backup starters that are slotted in the bullpen. They could make a spot start once in a while, but they're also sort of your guy that you go to if you got to pull your starter early, and this guy can probably go 5 innings. But then imagine that on the back end. Imagine a guy like, who is our guy, Todd the Painter? What was that guy's name? Mustache
Don't
for
remember.
The Tigers. Fuck.
Todd Jones?
No, Tyler something. He was
Tyler Anderson. Like,
is that right?
Tyler Anderson?
Either way, he was a long reliever, and he was awesome. You know, sometimes he'd make a start. Most of the time he was in the bullpen, and anytime you called on him, he'd get the job done. He'd eat innings.
Yep.
I think that there's definitely a world where when pitchers' workloads are literally damaging their bodies actively, I don't think there's anybody's willing to change this whole concept of spin rates and going fucking nuts in order to get the right amount of spin and fastballs and stuff. Tommy John might be the reality for every player at this point, which sucks.
Yeah.
But I think you bring up a great point that we could spread the love in these bullpens a little better and come up with a new role for pitchers.
Thank you. Yeah, to your point, I know I picked on Jordan Lyles a little bit earlier, but last year he was one of the pitchers who went over 140 innings. He went 177.2 innings. And I just recently read an article, I believe it was on The Athletic, about the death of the innings eater. Like, there's nobody out there who just eats innings anymore. And Jordan Lyles is an inning eater. 177 innings. That's what constitutes an innings eater this year, these days. He didn't even make it to 200, 177. If you could get a couple dudes on your team that can give you 140 to 175 innings over the course of the year and pitch healthily into the postseason and not get injured, why wouldn't you want that?
That's the winning formula.
I think it's the winning formula. Folks, remember when you hear this episode, I said it first.
Well, Carl, thank you so much for sharing that. Your cat is so perfectly in the frame right now. Like, they are posing.
She does that. Yeah, that's Bonnie McMurray. She is like her brother Squirrely Dan, named after characters on one of my favorite shows, Letterkenny. And she does like to sit there and just look beautiful. She also likes to sit over on top of the cabinet behind the toilet in the downstairs bathroom and stare at you while you poop.
That's awesome.
So, you know, hey, my son's here to go to bed, so I think this is a good place to wrap it up. What do you think?
I think so. Next week we're going to have our Super Bowl special, and I'm going to keep the subject a little vague, but we're talking football and baseball married. And I'll tease it at that. Carl, thank you so much. I heard you guys have a Patreon now for Cheap Smut.
We do. We have a Patreon for Cheap Smut. Patreon.com/Cheap Smut. It's only $1 because that's what we're all about. $1 gets you all kinds of fun stuff, like us doing adult Mad Libs, which was a lot of fun. I'll send you the link. It was a good time. So thank you for bringing that up. I do appreciate it. Cheap Smut is the other podcast that I host. We are currently with my wife, Katie. She reads cheap, smutty books and then explains the plot to me, and I have no idea what's going to happen. And we have an absolute blast. Matt was a guest on an episode, The Pitcher's Assistant by Jessica Kane, which we reposted as one of our best episodes of season one because it was such a good time.
And just a fun show in general. And you guys are just a blast listen to. So check out
Cheap
Smut.
Thank you so much.
I have nothing to plug at the moment, but I will in a couple weeks, and I'll tease that as well. But until then, folks, thank you so much for listening, and we will see you next week.
Put Me in Coach is an Arctic Sounds original podcast hosted by Matt Coggins and Carl Mizell. Theme music is by Quack Quack Seatback. Edited and produced by Matt Coggins. Check out the footnotes of this episode to see links to all the great highlights, articles, and sources we mentioned on the podcast today, as well as the full theme song and ways to get in touch with us. For more, find us on Twitter and Instagram at PutMeInPod or at our website, PutMeInCoachPod.com.